will argue for appellant, Mr. Richard Gregory, and Mr. Ken Bo will argue for appellee.
Thank you. And before we proceed, I was remiss in not introducing our visiting judge today. We're pleased to have with us Justice William Brigham, who used to serve on this court, and he's agreed to sit with us during this particular month. And, of course, we also have Justice Bob McCoy, who's with us as well. And I forgot to introduce them today. So we will now proceed. And, Mr. Key, if you're ready, we will begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The case we're here on today is an appeal of a bench trial in an insurance-related case. My client, Aaron Bruton, is an independent trucker, owner-operator of his own truck and trailer. He had insurance coverage through the appellees, underwriters at Lloyd's London. And the claim was handled by Marshall Contract Adjusters, another appellee in this case, Mr. James Nichols. First things first, I have two issues that are presented to the court. The first issue was the failure to find findings of facts and conclusions of law, and the other issue is the question of equitable title. The order is not an indication of the importance of the issues, but merely the logical order. I felt I'd be remiss in not bringing up the fact that the trial court failed to find findings of fact and conclusions of law, even though they were timely requested. But I do believe all the parties understand the basis of the court's ruling, which was simply that there was the equitable title passed to the insurance company upon the submission of the claim, and I have briefed accordingly, and I briefed that issue. So obviously if there were other issues that the court thought was important, it's kind of hard to figure them out without the findings of fact and conclusions of law. But we know that issue is important because the judge told us that was the key issue. That's what his letter ruling said. So I briefed the issue, and if the court's ready to decide the case on that basis without abating for findings of fact and conclusions of law, I'll defer to the court on that, but because I think we can discuss that issue based upon the record as it stands. With regard to the issue of equitable title, I think the appellee's brief probably sums up what the claim comes down to pretty well on page 15. They say that Bruton could also have not made a claim under the policy and repaired the trailer himself. He chose not to do that. Essentially, what the insurer is saying is that once my client submits a claim, a proof of loss, that creates an irrevocable option in the favor of the insurer to acquire that trailer by tendering the policy limits if it concludes that the loss exceeds the policy limits. That's the net effect of the insurer's position in this case. And I don't believe that the policy goes so far as to create that kind of irrevocable option, nor to force my client to make a decision as to whether or not to enforce his policy rights without knowing where he stands vis-a-vis the insurance company. Until he knows what the claim is going to be adjusted for, he's having to make that decision totally in the dark. And that's the posture the insurance company says he has to be in.
But doesn't he know all that when he accepts payment?
He didn't accept payment. That's exactly the problem in this case. He got a draft from the insurance company about 8 days, I think, after 8 to 10 days after the accident, that says, here's your, we're going to pay you $9,000 upon you signing this power of attorney, transferring the trailer to us. He did not do that. He refused to accept that payment and called his insurance agent and told them that he was not interested in settling on that basis. He wanted to see if he could acquire the trailer on the salvage basis, but at no time did he ever indicate his willingness to accept that settlement and to give them the trailer. He didn't want to do that. But that's exactly the position the insurance company says. Once you've already submitted the claim, it's too late to make a decision. You have to know before you submit that claim that if we find that the damages are more than that insured limit, we automatically acquire equitable title and you're out of luck. That's exactly what their position is in this matter.
Well, wait a minute. Let's say he had insured it for $1,000, and there was $1,100 damage. I don't think it's their position that if they tendered him the $1,000 less the deductible, suddenly the trailer's theirs.
I think that's exactly their position, Your Honor. That is exactly the position they're taking in this case.
All right. Well, we'll ask Mr. Gately that here in a minute.
Okay. And they do that without finding anything in the insurance policy that advises them that this creates any type of option agreement, that it creates any type of equitable interest on the part of the insurance company. All they can cite to is the provisions on protection of salvage and no abandonment. And nowhere in that policy does it make it clear that once you submit a claim, you're effectively giving them the option to acquire title to that vehicle. In fact, the insurance company demands on their behalf a right to inspect the vehicle and 60 days to make payment on the claim. They demand time to inspect and know all the facts before they make a decision, but they're not willing to give the insured that right. And the reason they won't do that, they say, is, well, we have to take this and put it in salvage, and we're doing that to protect you because every day it's in salvage, that cost accrues against the insured if you end up keeping it. And so they're saying, well, we're just looking out for you. But they're looking out for you by requiring you to make a decision without all the facts and without the same knowledge that they have when they make a decision whether or not it's covered and how much to pay. The cases that they cited on this point, every one of these automobile cases is just like Justice Livingston envisioned, where the insurer gets the settlement, cashes the check, and then wants to get the property back. That didn't happen in this case. We did not accept the proceeds. We didn't sign the power of attorney. We said, wait a second, we want our trailer. And when we went and made an investigation to find out what happened to our trailer, our client was told that the trailer had been destroyed. Now, I think that may be a disputed fact issue, but I don't think that for purposes of this appeal, I think the equitable title issue is going to decide all that, and we don't really have to get into the fact disputes because I don't think any of the disputed facts were key to the trial court's ruling. I think the trial court's ruling, as I understand it, was premised solely upon the conclusion that the insurance company acquired equitable title when they tendered that settlement. Therefore, all our claims against both the insurance defendants and Mr. Coggins and his company had to fail because the insurance company acquired equitable title. They were able to pass that to Mr. Coggins. So I think that's the key issue, and I don't think any of the issues on timing or facts disputes or who said what would really matter in this appeal. I think it all comes down to a construction of the policy and whether or not the mere tendering of a settlement that pays full policy limits gives the insurance company automatically, with no action on behalf of the insured, title to the insured property. That's the whole sum and substance of this case. That's the only issue on which this turned.
Well, when your client submitted the claim, what was he expecting to happen?
He was expecting, and my client, you have to. There's evidence in the record that my client is familiar with the cost of repairs, frequently worked on trailers, and had knowledge of it. He expected basically to get a claim in for.
Is this a $1,400 figure or whatever?
Something considerably less than the policy limits to repair that trailer and get back into operation, because that's exactly what he wanted to do. He never envisioned that this trailer was going to be deemed a total loss, even if you accept that it was underinsured. And again, that's when we talk about underinsured, he has to guess when he buys the trailer and gets the insurance as to what the value is going to be on the day he has an accident. So I understand that to some extent that the value of the policy, that's within his control. But he doesn't have perfect knowledge. But still, he has no reason to assume when he submits that proof of claim that this is going to be a total loss. I see that my time is getting short. I didn't take my full 15, but I think, Your Honor, the issues are pretty simple, pretty straightforward.
So what is it you're wanting on behalf of your client as far as action by the insurance company once they submitted you the check?
At that point, the only thing he could force them to do at that point is either either he accepts it or he doesn't, and he takes nothing. He takes his trailer back, repairs it, spends $1,400, gets back on the road, and starts making money. Now, we wanted to negotiate a deal to acquire the trailer salvage. We couldn't force the insurance company to do that. I concede that. I'm not saying that they had to do it. But they wanted to deny us the option of whether or not to proceed with our claim under the policy. They say once you submit that proof of claim, you've made your decision and you can't go back.
Okay, so what's unique about this case is that normally the insured is complaining that the tendered claim is too little. In this case, you're saying that the tendered amount from the insurance company is too much. So that's why it's probably going to be hard to find an analogous case.
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Key. Mr. Gately?
May it please the court. Richard Gately and Elaine Mars, Elaine Sanders Mars. She should be up here arguing, not myself. She wrote the brief. And she is the one who guides me in every step I take. Let me answer Judge McCrory's question. This is an agreed value policy that's admitted in the brief of the appellant. And I'm asking myself, much as the panel may be asking itself, why is Lloyd's of London and the insurance adjusters here today? We paid the policy limits. We paid the policy limits. In 7 days of the accident, we sent an independent appraiser there whose job was to bring the trailer back to the condition it was in immediately prior to the loss. Not a jack-a-leg repair. If we had offered a jack-a-leg repair, we would be sued for not paying enough. Underwriters are not the ones that chose what the value of the trailer was. Underwriters had no information on which to base the policy limits. That was a request made through the retail agent for Mr. Bruton. So why are underwriters here? The reason the whole issue of equitable title is important for your decision is because it's through that decision on equitable title that Mr. Bruton wants to keep his trailer. And all you have to do to show this is the case is look at the relief he requests. The only relief he requests against underwriters on the last page of his brief is he wants a new trial on extra contractual claims. He doesn't even assign that as a point of error. And in not assigning that as a point of error under Rule 38.1E of our appellate rules, he's waived that. He's also waived it by not discussing any reference to the record whatsoever about why he wants the new trial. He hasn't cited one record site. He hasn't made one argument. And under Judge McCoy, under your case of MJG, he's waived it under Rule 30.1H. So the relief he wants against underwriters is a new trial. That is what you'll find. Now, it's important to him to get the equitable title issue because if he prevails on the equitable title, if you look on his relief, his only relief against our co-defendant, is he wants the quiet title to his trailer. Why? Because he sought and obtained a temporary order to get the trailer back during the pendency of the litigation. I bet you he still has that trailer. And so if you grant the relief he asked for on the last page of his brief, he will end up with $9,000, which has been paid to him, which is the full amount of the policy less his deductible. And if you quiet title, he will end up with his trailer. And that will be against every principle in the book, particularly if you want to look at Vest v. Gulf Insurance in our brief. Mr. Bruton will now get an economic gain because he will have a $15,000 trailer, which he says that's what it was worth, and he will have it in his possession and have received $9,000 from underwriters. But the equitable title, yes, Elaine and I spent a lot of time in our brief on that, but that's not really underwriters' issue. That was my epiphany this morning. I said to myself, gee, why am I going over to the Court of Appeals and wasting time when I could be home fixing Thanksgiving turkey? Why? Because he's not asking anything from under ours except a new trial on his extra contractual claims. The undisputed facts are before you in the exhibit, defendant's exhibit, right in front of me. The policy language is just like the policy language in the Hamby case. Hamby had policy language in it which said, State Farm said, we will pay for the loss. And when we pay for your loss, which is what underwriters did in this case, it said, quote, we may keep all or part of the property at an agreed or appraised value. It was at their sole option, and you've read my cases in the brief. This is the same language we have in this exhibit that I'm pointing to you here, the same language. If we pay you the full value of your loss, which in this case was an agreed value that Mr. Bruton set and chose for a lower premium, we get to take the property.
Well, now, let's go back to my $1,000 question.
Well, that's a great question, and frankly, I don't know the answer because it's so far out of the realm of possibility that Mr. Bruton would pay a premium for a $1,000 policy on a trailer that cost him more than $1,000. I don't really know the answer to your question.
You know, I can see where you couldn't afford insurance for the whole anything, trailer, building, home, whatever, and you can only afford so much insurance, so you take out as much as you want you can afford. I'm assuming that's what he did here.
Well, I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know that.
That's a fair answer.
I know. I don't know that. Okay. I know that it's admitted in the record. It's admitted in the record, in the reporter's record, that he is the one that chose that value.
So if the repairs had not come back to be almost the full value of the trailer, like within a few hundred dollars, 14 something, if they'd have come back $10,100 and you'd tendered the amount, then you would still have a right to the trailer under your scenario because you've tendered the full amount, regardless of the trailer's value before or after repairs.
That's right. And in the usual case, Judge, in the usual case, there's a co-insurance penalty.
Well, it just doesn't seem fair that you're able, by tendering the full amount of the policy, to obtain a trailer which may be worth more than that after you repair it.
Well, but we don't repair it, Your Honor. We sold it for salvage. The salvage value on the trailer, as the record shows, was $800. So whatever Mr. Bruton thought he could fix, a fender here, a fender there, to get it back on the road or to make it look pretty, our obligation under the policy was to pay to restore the trailer to its condition immediately prior to the loss. And you know, any insured, if he wants to, can say to the insurance company, we want to buy the salvage and so forth and so on. But you can see from the timeline in front of me, he didn't do that until November. The problem is that the trucking company, Coggins, sold the trailer without the knowledge or consent of underwriters. That is what has created this appeal. Usually what happens, the casualty trucking company, you know, they take those cars, if they buy a car that's a total loss and they don't know anything, they put it in a separate part on their lot. They don't do anything with it until they get the title straight. And that's why I put this exhibit up here. The only thing that underwriters did was say, you know, get it out of the wrecking yard so that you don't have any storage fees and hold on to it, and we're working the title with the insured. Now, the insured could have timely come back, Mr. Bruton could have timely come back and said, well, I want the salvage value, so I'll just take this and that for my trailer. Let me keep the salvage. That is a simple mathematical calculation. You've read the record. It's only 266 pages long. You've heard what the insurance company has said. We would have worked on that if that's what he wanted to do. But when he called and said, I want my salvage in November or whenever it was, they said, fine, talk to the casualty truck. Well, as far as underwriters knew, Casualty Truck still had the trailer. We didn't know that they had sold the trailer for $1,500 to Willie Bradford. We didn't know that. There was no expectation on our part. But because we had equitable title, having submitted, as you said, Justice Livingston, we submitted the proof of loss to him. We told him what the money was that we were going to give him. We didn't hear any word from him. We moved to protect his interest so he wouldn't incur storage fees, because had he incurred storage fees for the wreck, that would have gone against his limits. And at $100 a day or whatever those were, I'm making something up because I don't remember, but whatever those storage fees were, it would have just reduced what we would have paid him. That wasn't fair to him. So my request to you, to this panel, is to look at his relief, to rule that he has waived any error on appeal on his extra contractual claims for the new trial, because he didn't assert that error as a point of error. He hasn't asserted it today, and because he didn't brief it. And the judgment is fine, at least as regards underwriters, is fine as it stands, because it's not manifestly unjust. It's not against the great weight and preponderance of the evidence on his extra contractual claims. And if you have some other problems with something else about quiet and title, that's really not my issue. So therefore, I'd like, unless you have further questions, I'll turn it over to co-defense counsel. And I'll.
Seems like in normal contractual construction, there's a tender, but then there has to be an acceptance. And here, your position is, under the contract, we tendered, and there doesn't need to be an acceptance.
Well, it's the same thing in Hamby, Your Honor, because of this language in the policy, right here. Once we pay the agreed or appraised value, we have the option. And under the Rocco case cited in the brief, the insured has nothing to say about that. But the insured waived. He waived his right to answer your question. He didn't act until November. That's undisputed. If he had a problem with that, he could have picked up the telephone and said, I have a problem. I don't want this. He didn't. And he had, as Justice Livingston said, he knew exactly what we were paying for the trailer. He could have picked up the phone and said, I'm not going to take this. Go away.
Okay.
I withdraw my claim. Thank you.
All right, Mr.
And again, happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. Mr. Rotramble? Did I say your last name correctly?
Yes, you did, Justice Livingston.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Good morning. I'm Chair Rotramble, and myself and my partner, Brenda Brown, represent Casualty Trucking Equipment and Bobby Coggin. I'm not going to talk too much about the first issue that appellant brought as far as the trial court's failure to file finding of facts and conclusions of law. It's already kind of been commented on both parties, and we agree with what Mr. Gately has stated. But what I would like to comment on just for a brief second is what appellant had contended in his brief concerning title to the vehicle, concerning the Certificate of Title Act. The appellant contends that under the Certificate of Title Act, specifically Section 501.071, where it says the motor vehicle may not be the subject of subsequent sale unless the owner designates in the Certificate of Title, actually transfers the title at the time of the sale. Of course, the law also states that any violation of this would make the sale void. And we agree with that. We agree with that contention that appellants made. However, where the appellant falls a little bit short is they fail to talk about Section 501.005, which deals with conflicts in the Business Commerce Code. That's also under the same chapter of the Act. There it makes a specification as far as it provides that Chapters 1 through 9 of the Texas Business Code that controls over any conflict provision of Chapter 501 of the Act. Now, how does that apply with what we're talking about here? What we're talking about here is we're talking about a trailer, and it's already been distinguished that a trailer is a vehicle under the UCC as far as the definition of goods. So since the UCC is actually incorporated by the Texas Business Commerce Code, we specifically look at Section 2.401B. That's where the conflict lies. The as stated previous under the Act, the person who has a title has to transfer a title at the time and performance of the sale. Specifically under Section 2.401B, states that unless otherwise explicitly agreed, title passes to the buyer at the time and place in which the seller completes the performance. And this is even though the document of title is to be delivered at a different time and place. And what I'd like to do is to bring the court's attention as a specific case that's already dealt with this issue. And specifically, it's Vibbert v. Parr Incorporated. And the site of that's 224 Southwest 3rd, 317. That's a Texas Appeals Court in El Paso, and that was in 2006. In this case, we're essentially, like I said, we're dealing with the same issue. We have a conflict between the two laws here. What the court did in Vibbert, they looked at this Texas Certificate of Title Act, and they saw how it was incorporated and where it came from. What they said is the legislature essentially came up with this law for three reasons. One was to lessen and prevent the theft of motor vehicles. Two, the importation into the state and traffic in of stolen vehicles. And three, state encumbered vehicle without disclosure to the purchaser of a lien secured by the vehicle. However, the purpose of this act, though, was not to prevent sales and transactions in interest of motor vehicles or vehicles in general. They go on to look at another case, First National Bank of El Campo v. Bus. That's site is 143 Southwest 3rd, 915, 919. This is also a Texas Appeals Court out of Corpus Christi in 2004, where this court said that sell a vehicle without the transfer of the certificate of title is valid between the parties as long as the purposes of the certificate of title are not defeated. And also that under the UCC, title to a motor vehicle passes to the buyer upon delivery or possession, even though certificate of title will be delivered at a later date. Where they finished off with the case here is they looked at the dissent by Justice Wright in Gallus v. Carbiz, where he stated that in the same factual transaction, if the same factual transaction can harvest different results under different statutes, the statutes are in conflict, thus triggering the conflict provision. Therefore, in this situation, the code trumps. So how do we tie all of this in together? Essentially, what we have here is when appellee sent an appraiser out to appraise the appellant's trailer, the appraiser made an objective determination that the damage to the trailer was more than what the policy limits were that he had the trailer insured for. With that taking that information, appellee underwriters tendered payment in the full amount of the insurance policy minus the deductible. And appellant did receive the check. Now, since he did not sign a return the power of attorney concerning this trailer, under the Act, which is what they contend, title wouldn't have transferred, and this transaction would be void. However, by the express language of the Act itself, it gives control to the code. And because of this, because the code controls, we have to determine that the title transferred at the time of appellee, granted possession of the trailer, and also made payment on the trailer, regardless of whether or not he signed the power of attorney at the time he received it.
Well, wait a minute. Casualty paid the storage fee.
Yes. Right?
What else did you pay for it?
At this time, they haven't made any, as far as any money toward anyone, they haven't made any other payments for as far as expenses and so forth. What we have.
Well, how can you claim ownership without title without having paid for it? Okay.
My client is in the business. He's a storage, mm-hmm. in the storage business. Mm-hmm. And as in the course of dealings, what he's done, and he's done business with underwriters before, is what you do is you pay for the storage to pick the trailer up. You incur expenses and everything to get the trailer back out of the storage to where his shop was. And at that time, once title is transferred and given to him, he pays the balance.
But he hadn't paid the balance when he sold it, so he hadn't paid anything for it.
He hasn't paid the balance as of its time, but he was waiting to pay the balance once he received title.
He didn't receive title, so... I mean, I'm hearing you. If I paid you $1,000 for your car, I might be able to turn around and sell it because I hadn't technically received the title yet, but you hadn't paid for it. You're just holding it.
Well, he hasn't paid for the title, but at no time was he ever told to hold on the trailer. At no time was he ever told that he couldn't sell the trailer.
Well, that seemed to be – are you going to course of dealing?
Yes.
But I kind of got the impression that the course of dealing was not that you would sell it before you had title.
Well, like I said, in general course of dealing with what he's done in the past, like I said, my client's been doing this for over 20 years, and that's what they do as far as a course of dealing is. You get your award letter from the insurance company to pick the trailer up. You pay for what fees that are required during the time the equipment's there, would it be storage fees or whatever it might be associated with that. You bring the trailer or the vehicle into your possession, and at that time, whenever you receive title, you pay for the rest of whatever you're...
And then you sell it.
Yeah.
But you didn't do it that way this time, so...
Well, like he did sell a trailer, but at that time, like I said, no one has ever told him that he couldn't have a hold on the trailer or any other encumbrances that would have come with that trailer. And at this, just as far as the timeline goes, just for a brief second, I'd also like to add that, like Mr. Gately said, appellant does... There was an agreement to that. He has had the trailer... for quite some time, I believe over about a year and a half or so. So it is in his possession that we did not have possession of the trailer. And I don't have anything else to say in regards to this. If you have any questions, I'll do my best to answer any questions that you may have.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Rotrample. Mr. Gately, rebuttal.
Mr. Key.
I'm sorry, Mr. Key.
Well, I don't know. Mr. Gately might have some rebuttal to that.
But I think I get it, Your Honor. So.
Your Honor, I do better than stand up. So, Your Honor,
Just very briefly, Your Honor, I've heard a lot of talk about time. If time was really an issue in this case, they wouldn't have sent their settlement by regular mail. Their timeline shows that, which is they have in the appendix, and I had a big chart here somewhere, that they...
It's in front of you.
Okay. They sent it on October 24th. My client testified in trial, and there's record reference in the brief, that he received it on October 31st, and their timeline shows that he calls Mr. Nichols, Marshall Contractors, and inquired about the salvage of the vehicle at that time. I don't think there's any case for anybody to be worried about delay or whatnot. My client proceeded at least as expeditiously as the insurance company on this matter. I think it all comes down to the equitable title issue.
When did he reject? There's a difference between inquiring about salvage and rejecting.
That's their spin on it, is that he inquired at that time. I mean, our position is he told him, no, I don't want to do that.
Is that in the record? In the 262 pages of record, find that?
I think you'll find that he testified that he told him that he didn't want to accept that settlement. He wanted the trailer. Now, whether he used the magic words, I reject your tender of settlement, even if that means that I'm getting nothing into the policy, I don't know if he said that, but I think he made it clear to them that he wasn't going to cash that check and accept the settlement. I think he made that clear, and I think that is in the record. With regard to the Hamby case, again, it is like every other case where the insured has accepted the check and assigned the title. Didn't happen in this case. I mean, it's interesting to sign it, but it's just a different type of fact situation than what we've got here. On the briefing issue, I discussed our other claims on page 12, but I believe from the court's ruling the equitable title decided every issue on every claim, because the court's view was that if equitable title passed to the insurance company upon tendering a settlement, then we had no case on any of the extra contractual claims. We had no case to quiet title against Mr. Coggins and his associated companies, because if title passed, that disposed of all our claims. So that's what was briefed. I think based upon the record such as it is, where we have a judgment and no findings of fact, I think that was about all I could brief at this point without trying to guess every possible issue that might come before the court. I think everybody understands exactly what the court's ruling was, what it was based upon, and I think I briefed that adequately.
Are you trying to tell us that if, in fact, the equitable title question was wrongly decided in your and now we're in your favor, that would entitle you to extra contractual damages without any other point of error?
I think that we have to remand to the court to find how it would rule on the rest of the issues regarding that. I mean, we can't reverse and render because we don't have a court's ruling on damages and whatnot. I mean, I don't know how we would decide that at this point without more guidance from the trial court.
I guess what I'm getting at is there's no issue before us that if you are correct on equitable title that would give you a cause of action for extra contractual damages, bad faith, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I mentioned that under my equitable title brief because I think that was inherent in the court's rulings, that because they had equitable title, your extra contractual claims fail of necessity. If they did all that they were required to do under the insurance policy, then you have no extra contractual claims for breach of good faith and or failure to timely pay. I think that was essential in the court's ruling.
Okay.
And I think that the title issues that were raised by Mr. Coggins' counsel, I don't think there's really any significance there. If equitable title passed to the insurance company, then they can pass it to Coggins. I couldn't conjure up a set of facts where we have a claim against Coggins when the equitable title passes to the insurance company. I'm not making that argument to you. I'm saying that the insurance company did not acquire equitable title, therefore Mr. Coggins could not have acquired equitable title to the trailer. And that's our position on this matter. So, that's all I have, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Key, and Mr. Gately, and Mr. Roe Tramble. We appreciate all of your arguments today and all of your briefing. Your case is submitted, and you're excused.